From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Dislocated worker. That's a bit of business lingo for people who are laid off for no fault of their own. New jobless claims haven't been this high in 26 years, but unemployment benefits don't last forever. So many of these workers are heading back to school to retool their skill set. Community colleges could give dislocated workers a path back to employment, but how will federal plans to revive the economy deal with the cost of education and training? With us today, we've got George Boggs. He's the president of the American Association of Community Colleges. How are you?
Hi.
So, George, are you seeing a lot of laid-off folks returning to community colleges for retraining?
Yes, we are, Farai. We're getting reports from across the country that community college enrollments are increasing dramatically as people are coming back to college to pick up the skills they need to prepare for their future.
I understand that Michigan, which has obviously been hit hard by auto losses, among others, is a place where you see this trend. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yes, Michigan, the industrial states like Michigan and Ohio are being hit pretty hard, but so are the states that were subject to the housing boom, California, Florida, Arizona, Nevada. The states are in very difficult positions. People are unemployed and going back to college to pick up these skills. This is a general trend that we see in any economic downturn when the economy changes and people are laid off or underemployed and seek to gain skills so they come back to our colleges.
Now, when someone comes to you and says, you know, or comes to a community college president and says, I need training for a career of the future, I need something that's going to last, not just training that's going to be obsolete, what kinds of training would you recommend?
Well, the hottest programs right now are in allied health or healthcare. In fact, nursing is the top choice among students today, and that's a pretty secure profession. All of the allied health careers, radiology, dental hygiene, nursing assistant, medical assistant, all of those programs are just booming at our colleges, as are the first responder programs, law enforcement, firefighting, EMT, paramedic. Those programs are exceedingly popular. Then, of course, we have the emerging science, technology, engineering, and math fields, in particular in green technologies. Those are becoming very popular, and of course the incoming federal administration is going to be placing an emphasis on those kinds of programs.
When you think about the fact that so many people are going to have to make financial decisions about whether to work at a job that may pay less than what they've been making before versus whether or not to go to school and incur the cost of going to school or try to do the work to find money. Why would you make a case that going to school is a good option, even if it might put you behind in the short term?
Yes, Farai. There's a lot of research that indicates that the more education a person gets, the better lifetime earnings will be, higher quality of life will be for that person. Of course, it does depend a bit upon what the student chooses to major in or to take at college. So we would encourage the students to find that career information, to speak with counselors before they decide upon an option for the future.
Now, have you heard anything about how the federal government is going to deal with things like providing extra money for job retraining? Are there any hints of how an Obama administration is going to tackle this?
Yes, we're quite encouraged by what we're hearing from the Obama transition team and, of course, candidate Obama when he was campaigning. In particular, he wants to increase financial aid options for students, to increase the need-based financial aid program, which is the Pell Grant program, to make application for financial aid simpler for students. He also has a plan called the American Opportunity Tax Credit Plan, which will consolidate the tax credits now, which really do not help low-income students very much, and make them more applicable to common people and lower-income people. In fact, it should make tuition virtually free for community college students, so we're very encouraged by a lot of these policies being promoted by President-elect Obama and his administration.
George, do you think there's a risk that community colleges could run out of money to create innovative programs?
Well, that's currently what's happening with the colleges. They have this tremendous tremendous enrollment pressure that we talked about caused by all the people who want to get retraining coming into the colleges right now, but funds are being cut to the colleges at the same time as the states are experiencing budget shortfalls. So it makes it very difficult for the colleges to accommodate all the students, and what I worry about is that many of these students will be turned away.
All right, George, thank you.
Okay, you're very welcome, Farai.
That was George Boggs, the president of the American Association of Community Colleges. And one of the hot job sectors right now is what's being called the green economy, that is, eco-friendly jobs in every industry from autos to home to food. President-elect Barack Obama has championed green jobs as part of his overall job creation plans. But let's take it from the worker side. Say that you don't know a solar panel from a shingle. How do you find green-collar opportunities? Richmond Build is a program in Northern California's Bay Area. It funnels young people from street corners to jobs in the renewable energy field. And Sal Vaca is the director of Richmond Build. Hi, Sal.
Hello.
So tell me a little bit about the community that you serve and why this is a good fit for your community.
Well, the city of Richmond traditionally has had a very disproportionate high unemployment rate compared to the county, compared to the state. In our city, we recognize that we have to be resourceful and creative in developing career and job opportunities for our residents, and recognizing that the green economy is one industry that is and will continue to generate those career opportunities. We forged ahead to develop partnerships with our community college or adult school and community-based organizations to design and develop a career track in the green economy, and specifically solar installation training for Richmond residents that in many cases, most of them barely even have a high school diploma, but really had no sense of a career opportunity in a green economy. Richmond Build is a program that's providing a pathway into meaningful, viable jobs helping us to address the unemployment situation in our city, which currently stands at around 11.6.
Wow, that's significant. And Richmond is a very diverse community. You've got some of the refinery areas around there. I know that sometimes people have had to deal on a community-based level with the issue of pollution. So do you think that people are ready in Richmond on a different level of seeing the environment as a resource and seeing some of the problems locally? Do you think that that adds to the importance of what you do?
It does add to the importance. And traditionally, we have been a heavy industrial city. But due to the economic changes, our economy and our economic base has been diversified. And the green industry is one that has a strong presence, a presence that continues to grow. And with a strong focus on solar technology, energy efficiency, solar thermal are some of the industries that we're looking to prepare our residents to connect with.
Now, give me an example of someone who you've worked with, a real person, and how your program has impacted them.
Yeah, case in point, Angela Green was a dislocated worker a year ago. From the printing industry, out of work, running out of unemployment benefits, and out of sheer desperation, she signed up to go through our Richmond Build program. Within 10 weeks, she received some solid training in the construction industry and solar panel installation. And within weeks of graduating, Angela was hired by Solar Richmond as a project manager. Fast forward a year later now, Angela is now teaching in the industry and has ventured out in establishing and setting up her own business in the solar industry. So that's one clear example and one face of the impact and the benefit that our program has made in this community.
Now, are people really seeking this out? Are people able to, for example, get the information that your program even exists, and then how are they how are people faring? Is there more demand for what you do than there is capacity?
Well, the solar industry continues to grow. In the Bay Area, there's over 250 companies under the solar industry banner, and most of those companies indicate a strong need for trained personnel. In our city, when we first introduced solar, most of our residents admittedly knew very little about the green industry, but now are starting to see that the green industry is one of those career paths that can provide viable alternatives to reducing unemployment and obviously gaining quite a bit of viable skills in a demand and growth industry.
Now, I asked this earlier of the George Boggs, who's with the American Association of Community Colleges. Do you think this administration is prepared to really do serious job training?
Yeah, we're excited with President-elect Obama and their commitment, their stated commitment to workforce development, in particular investment in the green economy. They've cited a commitment of over $5 billion to ensure that the businesses grow and that they are creating viable jobs in those industries. And we have been in constant contact with our congressional representatives to continue to highlight the need and the successes of the programs to ensure that there will be some opportunities, hopefully real soon and hopefully as soon as January, with a SIC and stimulus package that specifically addresses funding for dislocated workers and funding for training in the green economy.
If you had to paint a picture of what you really would want to happen in the future, just briefly, what would you like to see Richmond look like 10 years from now?
A city that's vibrant, that's thriving. There's a lot of positive aspects about our city, and we just need to continue to build on the current successes. We're continuing to diversify our funding base, and in the process of diversifying, we're able to create those career and employment opportunities that will ensure the vitality and viability of our community.
Well, Sal, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
That was Sal Vacca, the director of Richmond Build, talking about what are called green-collar jobs. And just ahead, does an immigrant from Kenya have anything in common with an African-American whose ancestors came here centuries ago? We'll look at multiculturalism within the black community. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Sometimes language gives us a powerful insight to the cultural debates of our times. The descendants of enslaved Africans have been called Negro, colored, black, and African American. But in the Obama era, African American might mean someone who just moved to America from Nigeria or Zambia, or someone whose family has been here for generations. You'll remember that not so long ago, during the long presidential race, some people debated if Barack Obama was really black, because he's the son of a Kenyan and the descendant of slave owners on his mother's side, not a descendant of people who were enslaved. What do black Americans from different ethnic backgrounds have in common? If you put a Latino, African, and Caribbean immigrant together, among others, into the mix with American-born black folks, how do cultures mix and clash? Today we look at multiculturalism in the black American community, and joining us today we've got Chope Ogunyemi, a Los Angeles-based media professional. She was born in Nigeria and came to the U.S. with her family in 1994, and Edwin Okongo, Associate Editor and Director of Communications for New America Media. Hi, folks.
Hi.
Hello.
So, you know, Edwin and Chope, you're both from Africa. And let me start with you, Edwin. What was your perception of what America would be like before you came here?
Well, I thought America was going to be a big old city and a lot of educated people and I thought I was going to be at the bottom of the class before I came here, and we just thought that, you know, this was going to be a place of money and everything was just good.
So how old were you when you came to the States?
I had just turned 20. This was 14 years ago.
And so you came here expecting kind of the city of gold.
Yes.
And what did you find when you got here?
Oh, a lot of difficulties. It took me 8 years to go through community college alone, and 10 years to get my bachelor's degree. And it's because I learned very quickly that you had to work, you had to learn things. Even though I spoke English and I've been learning English since I was a kid, it was different here. There are things, cultural things, I didn't understand, and it was really, really painful growing up. Trying to learn all those things. And
Now, did you move here with your family, or did you move here alone for school? How did you come, you know, how did you make the decision to come to the U.S. and who did you come with?
I have an uncle here who's been here since 1980, and he found me an admission to college, and I just packed my things. I came with a bag, and one of the things that they told me that you don't need any clothes. You know, America is a place where you work for a week and you take the rest of the week off or the month off, so you're gonna buy yourself a lot of clothes. So I came with a little bag and whatever I was wearing, and once I got here, I found that this place where because when we saw on TV, we saw that the America they show us is, you know, it's snowing and clean highways and big cars. And I thought, you know, when my uncle picked me up from the airport, we were riding in a Toyota 4Runner, brand new. And I'm like, wow, you know, I've made it. You know? And then getting to the apartment and finding out that the seven people who had gathered there that I thought they had gathered there to, you know, celebrate my arrival lived in a two-bedroom apartment.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk to you in a second about the work that you do with New America Media, which does a lot of work in tracking media for different ethnic groups, particularly immigrant groups. But we've got not only Chopay, but we've also got Jason Walker, president of the United for Jamaica organization, and who's at WRFG Radio in Atlanta. Jason, we've talked when we were down in Atlanta. I'm going to come back to you in a second, go to Chopay first. When you're listening to Edwin talk about, you know, his experience of first coming to the U.S., what does it call up for you?
Well, my experience was a little bit different. I moved here actually initially in the 80s as a young child and then moved back to Nigeria and then moved here finally in 1994. So I had some experience of what American life was, and that what Edwin talked about that immigrant mentality of really knowing that, you know, you're going to have to work really, really hard. The streets are not paved with gold, which is really a mentality I think that I find when I go back to Nigeria, which I do quite a bit right now. My family and friends think you've made it and it's so easy and everything just kind of falls into your lap and that kind of thing. I think that, you know, from my experience, I definitely grew up in the first couple of years when I lived in the United States. I lived in Los Angeles and I grew up in Ladera Heights, which is an upper middle class African-American community. So there was a great deal of difference for me in terms of being African and kind of the understanding that my African-American classmates and their families had about what it was to be African American, to be African versus African American.
Do you feel that, you know, you mentioned Ladera Heights, a very sophisticated neighborhood. Do you feel sometimes people say, okay, I came to the U.S., people had all these negative stereotypes about Africans, but there are also positive, you know, kind of, oh, they're, you know, they're so sophisticated, and you know, different people have different kind of points of view or you know, mm-hmm. sort of not just stereotypes, but ideas of what African life is like. Right. So what did you find when you went in, you know, as a girl?
80s,
yeah. What did you find?
It wasn't the sophisticated perspective, okay. I can tell you that much. It was definitely, you know, wow, do you live in trees? And, you know, do you hunt lions with mm-hmm. spears? And, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And I still get questions. It's interesting. I was talking to my father, actually, last night. And he mentioned, you know, 20 years ago when he first came to the country and having to deal with that and not seeing that. But as recently as a year and a half ago, you know, someone asked me, so are there only mud huts? I mean, you know, and I think that we've seen much more media coming from Africa and an understanding of that. But yes, so I think that there is some tension, I think, in terms of also what Africans, you know, kind of think of African-Americans, not just of America. Because I think, as Edwin said, you do find in places in Africa that Africans think that America is so easy. So they don't understand why African-Americans have some kind of gripe, I think, in some ways. They're kind of like, well, you live in America. Everything's great there. You know, you should be able to, you know, do whatever you need to do. So I definitely found different kind of perspectives.
Well, I'm going to go to you, Jason, and it's great to have you back on again.
Oh, it's wonderful being on such an award-winning and fantastic show.
Well, thank you. Well,
and congratulations on your awards this year, by the way.
Oh, thank you very much. We spoke in the context of ethnic diversity among black folks in Atlanta. And Atlanta is one of those chocolate cities where you have a huge black population and you have people, you know, we met people from East Africa, we met some of the Caribbean folks, of course, lots of American-born black folks. And do you think, you're someone who brings people together through music, among many other things, do you think that there is a new opportunity now with the discussion that went on during the political season of what blackness is and you know, the different ethnicities that black folks in America now come from? Do you think there's an opportunity to build some bridges?
There's a huge opportunity. I was right after Obama won. I had Yvette Lee Clark, who's a congresswoman from New York, whose mother is Jamaican. And she made the point, you recognize that this man is a first-generation American. His father is Kenyan. So already, without even trying, there's an immigrant conversation right there. I mean, right before he got his victory, there was a story of a relative of his that was here undocumented. So that opens a whole lot of doors for an opportunity for the average American who never hears this conversation, who never hears this perspective, to hear this conversation, that it's not as easy as black and white. There is a whole diverse collage, so to speak, of ethnic groups that exist in this country and are doing things and exist right beside you without you even possibly even knowing it.
When you talk to your friends who are, did you ever have the is he black conversation with any of your American friends? I mean, I had the is Barack Obama black conversation at my hairdresser's, I have to admit, and it kind of blew my mind away that we were even having this conversation, me and another client. But did you ever have that conversation about what does blackness mean in the context of America now, and in the context of specifically of whether people are immigrants or whether people are descended from the enslaved Africans who came to the U.S. Centuries ago?
Oh, well, definitely. It was interesting because all of my international friends, Caribbean, African, so on, were like, he's black. What's your point? Especially early, when persons really didn't know anything about Mr. Obama, I would hear from African Americans, who is this guy? What does he think? He wasn't even in the movement. He hasn't done anything. Where did he grow up? Hawaii? He didn't go through what I went through. He's not black. I heard that extensively. And, you know, I'm involved with community activism across nations and across the world. So I deal with a lot of people in various communities, and especially in the African American community in the beginning here in Atlanta, there was a lot of distrust when it came to this, to Mr. Obama. And they were like, he hasn't done anything for us. So, you know, he hasn't worked with us. He didn't grow up in our kind of reality. So, yeah, he's not black enough. I heard that extensively.
Well, I just want to remind folks or refresh folks who just tuned in midway, we are talking about diversity within the black American community. This, of course, is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We were hearing from Jason Walker, the president of United for Jamaica and head of the Caribbean Department for WRFG Radio in Atlanta. We've also got Chope Ogonyemi, Los Angeles-based media professional born in Nigeria, and Edwin Okongo, associate editor and director of communications for New America Media. So, Edwin, New America Media is what? Explain it to us.
Oh, it is, to put it briefly, it's sort of like the AP of ethnic media. And we come up with content and we try to help ethnic media. So a lot of people in the ethnic media are people with great ideas, but they don't always have the tools to execute those ideas. And so what we do, we give training to them, and we help them. You know, one of the things we're involved in right now is trying to help ethnic media to come online, to go online and have digital archives and also training them with editorial, you know, how to write stories and cover their communities. Because, you know,
now, let me just jump in, though. When you talk about their communities, give me, are there a lot of African immigrant newspapers, radio outlets? I mean, are there people who are from African and Caribbean nations who are starting local regional papers or national ones?
Oh yes. Before I came to this job, I worked at a paper called Chalet, which is based in Minneapolis, and we covered everything, you know, African issues of African immigrants. And the paper was started because, you know, as African immigrants, we living here, we go to the newsstands and we read about Americans and other communities that have established themselves, or we go online and we read about our brothers and sisters back home, but we weren't really reading about ourselves, and that's so there are papers like that that just cover issues of African immigrant, and a lot of into, you know, covering, you know, this event happens, but what we are trying to do is to get them to cover the real issues that write about
hard,
you know,
news.
Yeah, hard news. Elder depression is a big thing among the African community, and you know, issues of immigration and human rights. And so New America Media tries to give them the tools. We are a nonprofit organization, and we right. organize and we partner. We are partnering up with journalism schools across the country and try to have this workshop to have these people, journalists, to come for maybe a weekend training.
Well, let me get Chope in here. You're here in the studio with me in Los Angeles. I can see you taking notes. One thing I wonder is, how do you maintain ties? I mean, obviously, you, I'm sure, email, talk on the phone to to your friends and family in Nigeria. But on a broader level, how do you find out what Nigerians in America are thinking and doing?
Excellent. That's an interesting question, because I was really thinking about what Jason was saying. And I actually have written for an African-based magazine called African. It's called The African. And I wrote for their online section, africanmag.com. And really what I did was I profiled up-and-coming people of African descent in the United States doing things in business, arts, and education. And to me, that's really important, because I think what Jason said is – was that Jason, or I apologize if that was a
– No, That was Edwin.
I apologize, Edwin. What Edwin said about representation and really understanding what's happening for the African diaspora in Europe, in Latin America, in the Americas. And that idea of representation was very important for me when I moved here, back here finally in 1994. I moved to Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And I remember very distinctly, you know, understanding that my experience was a sideline to American popular culture. And that's really where I got my interest in media. And I studied that. My senior thesis in college was about race constructs and interracial dynamics. And so for me, right now, I also work for an organization called Real Medicine Foundation, where I'm working in healthcare, a little bit of a sideline for me, to establish basic healthcare clinics in Nigeria. And they work throughout Africa, in Mozambique and in other countries, in order to kind of give back in the communities and help with healthcare there.
Jason, you get the final word. Is it important for you to reach out and educate Americans about Caribbean culture more than just kind of what we know about Bob Marley and beaches? And if so, how do you do that?
It's extremely important, especially when you look at the numbers of those who are either Caribbean or of Caribbean descent. I think it's over 10 million by now throughout the United States, and how much they are involved with the process of everything that exists in this country. And, you know, you ask, how do I do it? Well, there are various of us, just like Edwin spoke about. When I started in media, I actually started writing for a local magazine called Caribbean Star, and I now work with a national online network called CaribLifeCentral.com. And there are various entities like this, and of course I use WRFG in the same aspect, to try and educate both Americans and Caribbean people, because a lot of times the Caribbean people don't even know themselves about how much they right. have contributed to this society and how much they're actually involved with the foundation of so on. So, you know, the entities like I said, like CaribLifeCentral.com and so on, where people can get that information.
All right. Well, there's so much to talk about, but this was a great start. Thank you so much, all of you.
Thank you, Farai.
We were speaking with Jason Walker, president of United for Jamaica, and he's also with WRFG Radio in Atlanta, joined us from Georgia Public Broadcasting. Also speaking with Chope Ogunyemi, a Los Angeles-based media professional, and she was here at NPR West, and Edwin Okongo, associate editor and director of communications for New America Media. And next on News and Notes, we look at an asthma study about black communities and find out why a good pitching arm is recession-proof when we do sports with Tony Cox and Bill Roden. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Black Americans are nearly 40% more likely to have asthma than white Americans, but new research throws an interesting curveball to that statistic. A study led by researchers at Tufts University found that black Americans born in the States are 3 times more likely to have asthma than their black neighbors who were born abroad. Joining us now to talk about the study is Doug Brigge, Associate Professor of Public Health and Family Medicine at Tufts University School of Medicine. Welcome.
Good to be here.
So this study focused on Dorchester, Massachusetts, and asthma, I understand, is very high there. Why was this? Why else was this a good community to look at when you were looking at black Americans, native-born and born abroad for asthma?
Yeah, this actually started from a community-based organization, the Boston Urban Asthma Coalition, that was concerned about exactly what you were saying, the high levels of asthma and the severity of asthma in the community. And they approached me, and working with some of my students, we did a community-based participatory research survey in Dorchester, in the community. And our original goals were really not to look at native and foreign-born. It was really to provide some data and some statistics that the community organization could use to further their ends. And it was after we had collected the data that, because of work I had been doing in Boston Chinatown and showing that foreign-born children were much less likely to have asthma, that we thought we would analyze this data for that as well and look particularly at the black respondents to the survey. And that's when this finding came out and that eventually led to the publication that we're talking about.
Well, what does it really mean to say African Americans or black Americans born abroad have such a significantly different rate? I mean, what conclusions, if any, can you draw from that?
Well, this is a first step, and we don't know exactly what's causing this. Actually, we don't know what's causing this difference at all. But we know that there's a difference. We've seen this now in Mexican immigrant children, we've seen it in Chinese immigrant children. In this study, looking at black adults and children, seeing that the foreign-born individuals were much less likely to have asthma. So there's something going on here, and what I think it points to is the need for more research to figure out what that is. I have a preferred hypothesis, or what I think is the most likely thing, and that is that that the infectious disease that people encounter in other countries that may be endemic there and is not very common in the United States, and this is a little bit counterintuitive, but those infections, parasites, bacteria, viruses, actually cause people's immune system to develop differently in a way that is somewhat protective against developing asthma or other allergic diseases. And that maybe that's what's going on. But what we need is research to look, not just to do a community-based survey, but to look at blood markers and much more detail about where people came from and whether they actually had these infectious diseases or not.
So if I understand you right, being subject to disease could actually help when it comes to preventing asthma.
That's correct. And this is something that is being looked at particularly with allergic diseases, but also with autoimmune diseases, where it may be that as human beings, our immune systems are, through eons of time, are used to having these infectious diseases. And in their absence, the immune system develops in a way that leads to reactions to autoimmunity in terms of in our own bodies or to things like pollen or cockroach or dust mite antigen that that normally should not be a concern for the immune system.
How big of a problem is asthma for Black Americans in general?
Yeah, asthma there's a higher prevalence of asthma in the Black community, but more importantly, the individuals in the Black community who have asthma tend to have more severe asthma, many more emergency room visits, hospitalizations, and even deaths. So this is a significant problem. And what we were looking at was really why people might develop asthma in the first place. That's this issue of how many people have asthma. The other issue is how severe is people's asthma once they have it. And if I just could, that what we know a lot about is people who already have asthma, what triggers their asthma, what causes them to have an asthma attack, end up in the hospital, things like that, including, as I mentioned before, many of these allergens. What we know very little about is why people develop asthma in the first place. And that's why I think this research we were doing, even though it was a community-based study, it was a participatory study, it was a survey, is providing some information that gets us started on thinking about why would one person develop asthma and another person wouldn't. And unless we do that, we have no way of doing anything about people developing asthma in the first place. And that would be some kind of primary prevention program that might mean that less children develop asthma than is currently happening in the United States.
Well, finally, what advice would you give to parents in particular who have children who either have asthma or you think might be developing asthma?
Well, I think the first thing is if they're not sure whether a child has asthma, then they really should see their physician, their pediatrician, and they should have them evaluated. Diagnosing asthma, I'm not a physician, I'm a PhD kind of scientist, but diagnosing asthma is something that can't be done with just a simple test. It's really a synthesis of information over a period of time. And so, and I think there are many children who have asthma and are not diagnosed, and their physicians and their parents don't realize it. So that's one thing. For children who already have asthma, I think there are two elements that should be considered. One is proper clinical management, which means that their physician should be prescribing the best state of the art medications for controlling their asthma, which would depend on how severe their asthma is. And the other is addressing environmental factors that are likely to trigger or exacerbate their asthma. And if they're allergic to dust mites, then trying to control dust mite exposure. If they're allergic to pollen, as I am, then, you can't actually eliminate the pollen in the air, but you can at least be aware of the seasonal pattern and use your meds more thoroughly at a time when the air is laden with pollen.
Well, great. Doug, thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being on.
Thanks. That was Doug Briggy, Associate Professor of Public Health and Family Medicine at Tufts University School of Medicine. We turn now to the week in sports, and for that we have our very own Tony Cox. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farah. You know, this week we are asking, what makes athletes do the things they do? For example, what makes a boxer keep boxing past his prime or his skills? What makes a baseball player turn down $140 million during a recession? And for goodness sake, what makes a professional football player decide to carry a gun? For answers, we turn to the one person we know whose job it is to find the answers, none other than New York Times sports columnist Bill Roden. Hey, Bill.
Hey, the great Tony Cox. I'm scratching my head, Tony, each one of those questions.
Well, let's start with this one, okay? In baseball, and CeCe Sabathia, he is a Cy Young Award winner, arguably the top free agent in baseball this year, turned down $140 million from the New York Yankees, only to reportedly accept $161 million over 7 years. He held out, Bill, for $20 million more. Is pitching really worth that kind of cash?
As Dwayne Thomas said, evidently. Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable. Brian Cashman flew out to Sabathia's home, was talking with Sabathia in his living room, and right then offered $20 million. I mean, You know, Sabathia clearly was not crazy about coming to New York. He wanted to stay in California where he's from. And the Yankees just made him an offer that he couldn't refuse. I mean, it's mind-boggling, Tony, just the amount of dollars.
It absolutely is. You know, what about this? If Sabathia does sign for that amount, what does it do to, or maybe for, let's say, the Angels free agent slugger Mark Teixeira? The Washington Nationals are already dangling $160 million in front of him, Baltimore $150 million. And what about the Dodgers' Manny Ramirez?
Well, all the people you mentioned are going to get paid. But I think this is – so the question is, well, how could these teams afford to do this? Well, what's going to happen? And it's sort of like the way society is in general, where these kind of heavy hitters are going to get paid. But where you're going to see the cuts are going to be sort of in these the middle class of ball players. A lot of guys are going to get released who are coming up on contracts that would pay them – $5-6 million. They're gonna be what they call non-tendered contracts. They may get waived. They may get released, invited back to spring training at minimum salary. So it's not like you're paying a lot of money for these heavy hitters and then paying a lot for the middle guys too. The middle guys, middle and lower guys, are going to get cut and waived. And they're going to rely more heavily on rookies.
You know, it's just crazy. Chicago offering Jake Peavy apparently something like $18 million or more, and at the same time that the company files for bankruptcy. I can't figure it out. Yeah. Let's move on to another topic. A few days before his fight with Manny Pacquiao, Oscar De La Hoya's statue was unveiled at the Staples Center here in Los Angeles. So now he has a likeness near one of Magic Johnson and Wayne Gretzky. Oscar was there at the unveiling being honored, and then a few days later he jumped into the ring, and you know what happened. He got hammered, unable to answer the bell for the ninth round. So here's the question. What is his legacy? Because there's disagreement about that around here at News and Notes. How would you rank De La Hoya with other fighters in his weight class?
Well, he looks like that statue they unveiled. Oh. That's what he looked like in that last fight. But, you know, Oscar was I'd say he was a great champion, but he was a lot like Sugar Ray Leonard in terms of what he did for the sport and for the lower divisions. And he was the golden boy. He paved the way for a lot of big money fights. And I think that in sports now, particularly in this climate, you have to rank people in terms of commerce and finance. And Oscar was the golden boy. He made it possible for a lot of fighters to get a lot of great paydays.
You know, you're absolutely right about that. In fact, he holds the record, $700 million total for 19 fights on HBO pay-per-view events. And even this fight pulled in 1.25 million subscribers, which puts him right at the top. Deserving of a statue or not, his pocketbook is certainly going to go into the Hall of Fame. All right, let's talk about something else. Guns and athletes. The Plaxico Burress story still going on. We all know by now that the New York Giants receiver shot himself in the leg while partying at a Manhattan nightclub. So the first thing people asked was, reasonably, what was he doing with a gun at the club in the first place? But an interesting answer, Bill Roden, came this week from Miami Dolphins linebacker Joey Porter, who defended his boy Burress with this comment. Until you've been in a situation where you've been robbed at gunpoint, or you've had a gun waved in your face, or you've been carjacked, you really don't know what it feels like, end quote. So, Bill, does he have a point?
Well, yeah, he does. I mean, that's true, that until that happens to you, you don't know. And it's an unfortunate reality that a lot of the athletes are targeted because, number one, they choose to continue to want to hang out and go places where they used to go. So, yeah, you're going to be targeted. And Burris's place, I just think it was recklessness and it was careless. I mean, you've got a gun that you don't know how to use, clearly. You don't even know how to lock it. And you're carrying your waistband and it accidentally goes off. You shoot yourself in the thigh. And he's just like you and I here talking about him blowing somebody else away. That's not about being confronted. That's about being reckless.
Well, you know, we do hear, as you say, that even if you're where you're supposed to be, that if you are where you're supposed to be, these kinds of things are not going to happen to you. So we'll have to see. It's a tragic situation, and it's costing him in a lot of ways.
And it's going to cost the Giants.
Absolutely. Already did, as a matter of fact. Let's talk college football. It's settled Florida, Oklahoma going to play in the national title game. The BCS has decided. However, Texas, who beat the Sooners head-to-head, get Ohio State in the Fiesta Bowl. Longhorns crying foul, Bill. I don't know. Did the BCS get it right?
They never get it right, Tony. In fact, I stopped watching college football at this point. This is now what I call the fairy tale part of the season. You know, they need a playoff. Even the president, your president-elect, called for a playoff. Everybody knows that you need a playoff. That big-time college football is the only division in the NCAA that does not have a playoff. And it's only because of money. They're trying to keep this bogus bowl system afloat and relevant. And it's really a disservice to the people who play the games. It really is unfair.
Well, now what about Alabama? Number one until they ran into Florida. They now face undefeated Utah in the Sugar Bowl. My question is, could a school like Utah ever win the national title, no matter how many games they win?
If you had a tournament system, yes. If you had an 18 tournament system, an 8-team tournament system, and maybe after the bowl game you choose four or six teams, yes, a team like Utah could compete. But in this circumstance and the way this sort of Wizard of Oz make-believe system is, it's really difficult. It's a stretch. And it's the closest thing we have to fiction in the NCAA.
All right, we've got about a minute to go for more of your nonfiction stories today, Bill. This one is coming up on the weekend. Tim Tebow, is he likely to repeat as the Heisman winner? You know, Texas's Colt McCoy and Oklahoma's Sam Bradford are also finalists.
I don't think so, only because of the way Oklahoma finished up. Bradford was looking just so strong. And Tebow, his production, I mean, I think he probably had a better season this year than when he won last year. But it's very, very, very unlikely that he's going to repeat, particularly the way Oklahoma finished up very strongly, very impressively.
All right, when you come back, we're going to talk about the NBA and whether or not the Celtics and the Lakers and the Cleveland Cavaliers are really the top and who is the best team in the league. We're also going to talk about who's the best college basketball player. I did happen to catch Stephen Curry from Davidson shoot lights out at Madison Square Garden the other night. So we'll talk about that next time. All righty?
Okay.
Bill Roden, a sports columnist for the New York Times, a regular contributor to this show, joined us from the studios of NPR in New York.
That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, the auto bailout cleared the U.S. House of Representatives, but does it have enough support to get through the Senate? We'll have the latest in the Detroit relief efforts.